Paul Ryan announces his retirement, could it have some Hoosier lawmakers worried? Joe Donnelly sets a personal fundraising record. That plus Todd Rakita and the Trump-Pence Indiana team and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending April 13th, 2018.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Speaker of the U.S. House, Paul Ryan, announced he won't run for re-election this year.
The Wisconsin Republican sent ripples through the political landscape with his announcement. He joins a record number of Republican House members who are leaving their seats this year. Many House GOP members publicly say Ryan's decision has no bearing on their battle to retain control of the House, but many speculate it's a blow to a party in which some are concerned about a so-called blue wave of Democratic support this fall. In Indiana, a member of U.S. House leadership, Congressman Luke Messer, is leaving his seat to run for the Senate.
Should Hoosier Republicans be worried about Paul Ryan's retirement? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and political analyst John Ketzenberger. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, can we really draw conclusions about Indiana's races from a Wisconsinite's decision?
Oh, yeah, you can. I mean, he doesn't want to be the minority leader, that's clear. And I don't know what his own polling numbers show. He's releasing his internal polls. I don't really put a lot of stock in that. But he has a very active opponent himself in Wisconsin. And I think people are fed up with the idea of one party in control, and they want a balanced approach, especially with who's occupying the White House. They want a check on him, and that's not Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell. So I think they should be worried about that, not just from the point of view that you have a record number of Republican incumbents retiring, but Paul Ryan was the cash cow. He was the one who raised all the money for everybody else's campaign. He's not going to be doing that for the rest of the term, and I think they should be worried.
Is that the biggest impact, is the fundraising capabilities that Paul Ryan brought to the table?
No, I don't think we're going to have to worry about spending too much money in 2018. That probably won't be on the list of things we talk about over the next 6 months. There's not enough money in these campaigns. A couple of things. One, I think we've been a little bit insulated from kind of like the unrest elsewhere to a certain degree. There have been protests here and there have been other things, but to draw a lot of conclusions, I think, about Speaker Ryan is, I think it would be overdone here. The one thing it has done, though, is undeniable. One, we have a record number of retirements. You have to look at that as something, right? So I think you look at why is Paul Ryan doing this? Well, he's scared to lose. I don't think that's right. I think there is a human component to this that we oftentimes just underestimate because we just look at these guys as, like, not human. Part of his comment was, hey, I just want to go home. You know, I kind of want to go home. I got young kids. They've seen me on the weekends for the last decade, and I just want to go home. That's part of it. The environment it doesn't look like very much fun to be in Congress right now. That's a lot of it too. But I think what I think we'll probably be talking about in a week or 2 weeks is how the narrative's turned nationally, and now you're looking at a lot of Democrats who are in Republican areas trying to run in places Trump won. Now they're being asked the question: wait, are you going to support a Speaker Pelosi? And we have an example of that. That very high-profile Pennsylvania race, the Pennsylvania 18th last year, that was the subject of the Supreme Court challenge and all that. Yeah. Conor Lamb won that, and he won it in part because he ran ads against D.C. Democrats. So it's going to get, as that narrative shifts and you start isolating people in Indiana districts,
but will he,
say,
but will he
are
vote,
you going to
but
support?
Will he end up voting for Democrats, which is all that
well,
Democrats would ultimately
you know,
really care
I guess,
about?
I guess,
I
but
love
I think it,
that
I think
it
puts
her,
a lot of attention on that piece of this.
That you make her the poster child with everything
She's the poster child
if you're going
to be in charge.
She's a powerful woman, and that sticks in the Republican craw.
I don't care about
that's
Come
what
on.
The, oh, yes, you do.
No, I don't.
She's uppity. She's outside the House.
She's not a 100-year-old white guy. I'm like 38 years old. I don't care about any of that. What are you talking about?
John Schwanis, he talked about this narrative. Well, the narrative right now, one of the narratives out there is that there might be this blue wave coming of Democratic support, a Democratic surge. Does this just feed into that even more?
It probably does feed that narrative. But if in fact, I think there will be certainly a rising tide, if not a tsunami. But I think the sandbags, to continue this rather strained metaphor, are positioned on behalf of the Republicans' incumbents around the state, the borders of the state of Indiana. I don't think, even though we would see, we're likely to see significant change and maybe even Republican control, I mean, I should say Democratic control of the House, I don't think we'll see dramatic wholesale changes in the makeup of the Indiana House delegation. But where it does cause, you get back to the notion, does it depress or cause anxiety? Not because it tells Republicans in Indiana, if they're incumbents, that they're going to lose. It just, what the anxiety would come from, it seems to me, is the notion of being in a minority after having served in the majority. And obviously, yeah, one is, even though, as Mike says, there's not a lot of fun, one's probably a little more fun than the other.
should Indiana are Indiana Republicans a little insulated from maybe the blue wave we might see elsewhere?
I think they need to take care about that, because there's a long time between now and the general election. You have two incumbent congressmen who will not be on the ballot. They'll have new Republicans on the ballot in those districts. And while at this point they look like they're fairly, you know, certainly in the second district, it looks like a fairly familiar name is likely to be on the ballot, I don't think it's an automatic. I think depending on what happens and depending on the momentum that Democrats can gain, I could see Indiana Republicans losing a seat or two in the coming election.
All right. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question: should Speaker Paul Ryan's retirement have Hoosier Republicans worried? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question: will Luke Messer's strategy so far of staying positive in his campaign ads help him or hurt him? Well, 85% say it will help him, 15% say hurt him. If you would like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly's campaign announced this week it set a personal fundraising record in the first quarter of 2018.
Donnelly began the year raising $1.6 million, the best quarter he's ever recorded. That's more than the number he posted leading up to the 2012 election. The vast majority of Donnelly's donations this quarter were small amounts, 82% were $50 or less, about a third of contributors were from outside Indiana. The Luke Messer campaign, one of the three Republicans vying for a chance to unseat Donnelly, sent out a fundraising email to supporters describing Donnelly's numbers as, quote, not the headline they wanted 1 month before the primary.
Mike O'Brien, some worry for Republicans at Donnelly's number?
I don't think so. I think if our money's split three ways, and we have people holding money back because they don't want to get involved in this, you know, in what is not a clear outcome in our primary. As far as record breaking, I think we're breaking these records every cycle. I don't think, you know, if you look back 10 years, these numbers look silly. I mean, they're so big now. It's great that it's record breaking for Donnelly, I guess. What was impressive, I mean, to give him credit, he did focus intentionally on going out and recruiting small dollar donors, you know, and they really made
82%.
And that does show breadth of support and buy into a campaign. I think Republicans will be able to match that. We're just kind of in this primary process right now. And if you add up all of the contributions that were made in 2017 among the Republicans, I think even before we've released the final numbers, I think we've eclipsed what Donnelly's total. So,
and obviously, use it all to attack each other. It's a beautiful thing.
Obviously, this is good news for Donnelly, but is this also just something he had to do, considering?
Well, I don't know if he had to do it, but I think Kelly Norton and Joe Donnelly have done an excellent job on fundraising here. And as Mike noted, the breadth of the small dollar donations show that an awful lot of Hoosiers think that Joe Donnelly is doing a good job. And not just that he's doing a good job and that they'll vote for him, but they're willing to invest their money into making certain that he's reelected. And I think the quality of the campaign on the Republican side is so negative and so awful. I just don't see the Luke Messer people and the Todd Rokita people writing checks to each other when this is all over. I think that damage is done, and it's done for a good long while. So Joe Donnelly is in a good position, not only fundraising-wise, but support-wise.
Maybe the Rokita and Messer people will be writing checks to Mike Braun, though.
Well, that may be. Or the other way around.
At the end of the day, we're going to have a lot of outside money in this state. Will it matter so much how much the campaigns each have?
No, because as Mike said earlier, there will be enough money. There will be no shortage of money for any candidate, certainly in November. But I do think that, you know, Joe Donnelly has run a very good campaign to this point, and to show that 82% of your donations are less than $50, and that two-thirds of those come from people in Indiana, does show a ground game. And I think Ann's point, those bruises are going to take a while to heal. And so the first order of business for whoever comes out of that primary is going to be doing what Joe Donnelly's been doing the last 3 months or last 5 months. So I think that the Republicans will end up behind in terms of the ground game and, you know, making amends internally, and Joe Donnelly will be miles down the road in that regard.
Obviously, if you set a personal fundraising record when you're in a tight race, you want to trumpet that, but has he now put himself in a position where he'd better hit new personal records in each of the two quarters before the election?
So what we're saying is this was the worst thing that possibly could have happened to this.
Set the bar too high.
Talk about spin.
He could perform at this level, and now he has to live up to it.
You just can't do anything good anymore.
I know. It's negative nabobs
of...
nattering nabobs of negativism.
Inevitably, that'll be what some people ask.
Namely you.
You know, I think he's happy to have set the record now. And if this campaign unfolds the way I think it will, where money, the spigot is open on both sides because of what's at stake, he probably will set another record. You're right about the notion that John, you pointed out that now the Republican who emerges victorious will have to do what Joe Donnelly's been doing, except Joe Donnelly didn't have to go out and mend all the fences.
Right, exactly. So they got actually a heavier lift.
And yeah. I think to some extent it's not just a matter of winning checks and financial support from those wounded allies, but votes, right, or just getting them off the couch come election day.
Yeah. The people who led the 2016 Trump-Pence Indiana team officially endorsed Congressman Todd Rokita in the Senate GOP primary this week.
Rex Early and Tony Samuel, the chair and vice chair, respectively, of the Indiana campaign for Trump and Pence, wrote a letter of support for Rokita last year. But this week, they officially endorsed the 4th District representative, saying he's reliably backed the president. That's even after a recent interview surfaced from before the 2016 primary, in which Rokita called Trump, quote, vulgar, and said he needed to act presidential.
John Katzenberger, the Rokita camp has been talking about the Trump-Pence team's support for nearly a year now. So will this week's event make much of an impact because of that?
Well, they certainly hope so. They're hoping that the people who helped engineer Trump's success in the presidential race translate somehow. I think it's interesting. I can't imagine how many times I heard Rex say when he was on this show, oh, endorsements don't matter. So, you know, now that he's making the endorsement... I'm sure he's hoping that it matters.
Well, that's because it wasn't his endorsement.
Well, that's the difference.
if Todd Rokita did get a boost earlier this week because of this, was it undone by the story that dropped last night that he may have violated an ethics law when he was Secretary of State?
First, I would just say, look at what Rex's endorsement for President Fred Thompson did. And that packed a punch.
No, you really hurt
back
me.
Back in the day. Yeah. What was your question? No, I mean, does it? You know, it is just... It's kitchen sink time. I mean, everything's getting thrown in. If you said this in 1964, you did this. You looked funny at somebody. You were cross. I don't know if anything's resonating right now. I think there's a saturation point perhaps that we've reached.
So is it resonating, or was this one step forward, two steps back for Todd Rokita this week?
I think at best it's a benefit to him. I don't think the AP story was a little odd in that it was couched as he may have violated the law. Well, he also may not have violated the law and probably actually didn't. And I think if anybody, Todd Rokita is going to trumpet the fact that he angered three GOP leading officials in 2009 and 2010. As far as the Trump endorsement goes, Rokita more than the other two, but all three have tried to capture what is popularity among the Republican base for the president. And that is real. Whether it's a threshold question for all of them or most of them, we'll find out, in May.
Is Todd Rokita going to be able to easily brush off this ethics claim?
This isn't the first ethics claim that's been against Todd Rokita. You know, as the now governor used to say, it constitutes or could constitute a culture of corruption in his office. So I don't know if he brushes it off in the middle of that food fight that constitutes the Republican primary. I don't know what sticks and what doesn't, except that all of them are reprehensible.
Don't hold back. Teacher strikes and demonstrations continue around the country this week as a report shows Indiana teachers may have taken a pay hit over the last several years.
A CBS News review of Department of Education data reveals that, adjusted for inflation, Hoosier teachers now make about 16% less than they did in 1999 and 2000. That's the steepest drop in the country. And that's as the state continues to struggle with a teacher shortage, something that's been the focus of legislative hearings and measures for a couple years. Across the country, Kentucky teachers recently protested at the state capitol for better pensions, while Oklahoma teachers walked out of classrooms to demand better school funding and increased pay. And West Virginia teachers went on strike last month.
John Schwannes, will we see Indiana teachers respond here like those in other states have?
I think there will. There has been frustration, and this seeing it in numbers in this cold, you know, blatant in-your-face way, and seeing that you're ranked number one in the country in a category you don't want to be number one in the country in terms of the diminishment of the buying power of the salaries is not good. What the difference is, though, in a lot of the states where we've seen marches on the state house and ongoing picketing and so forth and the strikes, decisions for teacher salaries are made at the state level. And so you have, it's much easier to say, you know, this X percent raise that the governor has proposed or the General Assembly has proposed is either sufficient or not enough, and speak in unanimity. Here, you're dealing obviously on a district by district basis with collective bargaining agreements, and so I dare say that
a march on the state house wouldn't be as effective.
No,
start talk.
And there probably are. Well, I don't think there are any overpaid teachers. Certainly, there are. There are some districts where the teachers are not hurting as much as others, I think it's safe to say.
We are coming up on a budget session in 2019. We're seeing a big bubbling up across the country right now. Will that sort of thing last until maybe a time when Indiana teachers could make a difference?
You know, I'll be curious to see because, you know, the summer is not really the season for teachers to gain the kind of attention that they might otherwise gain during the school year. But teachers in Indiana have a history of political clout. In the 80s, they were arguably one of the most powerful caucuses, blocks in the General Assembly. I'll be curious to see, because I think John's right. There's a disparity between funding and school districts in Indiana. It's because of the way that the formula has evolved and changed. And I'll be curious to see if suburban districts, for instance, and rural and urban districts, which actually have a lot in common when it comes to school funding, have the same kind of commitment to funding overall, bringing more money into the system, and then advocating that that money be used for teacher salaries as opposed to other programs or other things within the district. I think the potential is there, but it'll depend on some kind of a trigger, and I'm not sure what that might be in Indiana.
You talk about the Indiana teachers had some political clout in the past, and in some cases the recent past, certainly with the election of Glenda Ritz in 2012. Can they recapture some of that
Well,
right
you
now?
Know, Mitch Daniels started this to break the back of the teachers' union. They started the war against teachers how many years ago, and he's been successful in diminishing the power of the ISTA in this regard. And so the teachers at the moment don't have people who can stand up and point out the fact that here in 2018, they're not paid effectively adjusted for inflation any more than they were 10 years ago. And all the increases that the Republicans talk about, the vast majority of the increases in funding they talk about, go to vouchers. They don't go to the 90-some-odd percent of students who are in traditional public schools. So we have a real problem here in Indiana, and we have a teacher shortage. And guess what? When you denigrate what they do, and then you underpay what they do, and they're actually making less effectively than they were 10 years ago or 15 years ago, it's not surprising that intelligent people would choose other professions. So we have to get our act together as a state. We have to stop this voucher program expansion, which takes money from traditional schools. We have to compensate teachers correctly, and we have to give them the ability to organize so that they have somebody to advocate for them.
As I mentioned, we've been studying, Indiana has been studying this teacher shortage for a few years now because it's something that both parties are grappling with. Is it time to just say we need to pour a whole bunch of more money into salaries?
One, it's a national problem. I mean, we're studying it here because it's a problem all over the country, regardless of what you're investing in teacher salaries or in the system. I think we're spending at least 55 cents on the taxpayer dollar in the state budget on K-12 education. The problem isn't necessarily the big number in terms of financing and budgeting. It's how much of that money is flowing through to the classroom. And we've looked at there are different problems between suburban and rural funding. You know, in the suburban level, Avon's a good example. We have a referendum on the calendar for the May primary election. So people in Avon are going to have to decide, are we going to invest in this school and make sure that it's one of the best in the state or not? And is it going to continue, and is that dollar going to continue to erode in rural areas? Republicans in the State House have tried to, and members of both parties have opposed this, to be fair, to consolidate districts and to consolidate administrative functions in some of those districts to free up those dollars to put them into the classroom and put them into resources and salaries and things for more teachers. So there are ways to do this. There are ideas out there.
But the fact that it's 50,
it's really hard. It's really just been hard to get done here for a lot of reasons.
The fact that it's 55% is all done. That was all done by Mitch Daniels with the property tax freeze. Okay, so I mean, it's not the percentage of the budget. It is what is going in additional education.
Okay,
and it's still the vast majority.
But the relaxation of licensure requirements could be another trigger to John Quinn Hodges.
Right, which is why the vast majority of the dollars are going to
too much of the growth is going to vouchers.
Moving on, the Donnelly campaign this week launched an initiative targeting support from women voters.
In 2016, 53% of Hoosier women voted for President Donald Trump. But following the recent women's marches in Indiana, Donnelly supporters say they're confident some of those same women who voted for Trump will vote for the Democratic Senate incumbent. About 53% of women voted for Donnelly in his 2012 race against Republican Richard Murdoch.
And Delaney, Donnelly isn't exactly known for advancing women's issues in the Senate, and he labels himself anti-abortion. Will he have a tough time getting enough women to vote for him?
You know, he's running against Larry, Moe, and Curley, who, as far as I know, have never supported anything like equal pay for women or the Affordable Care Act or the Violence Against Women Act or any of the things that are important besides the issue of abortion to women. So I'm pretty confident the vast majority of women in this state are going to vote for Joe Donnelly and not either Larry, Moe, or Curley.
You'll have to tell me later which ones.
I'm not sure which 53% of Hoosier women voted for Joe Donnelly in 2012. 53% also voted for Donald Trump. Will that number stay roughly the same for Joe Donnelly?
We'll find out. I think Republicans in the state have a pretty good track record of putting women in positions of power. We have a majority of our statewide elected officials. They're all Republicans at the state level, and most of them are women.
No wonder you think they did a pretty good job.
We've done a good job trying to recruit women and organize women. Anne Hathaway does a great job with the Lugar series in that role. We just have a lot of women in the Republican Party in positions of power and influence that are good at organizing and good at people driving to the
women running as Democrats.
There are a lot more women running as Democrats.
That's
but
right.
Will Joe Donnelly be able to get enough women to vote for him when he isn't known as a champion for women in the Senate. That's just not one of the things he's known.
Which one of Larry, Moe, and Curley is?
I'm not saying they are. I'm saying Joe Donnelly isn't. So is he going to be able to...
If you judge it by the hair, then it might be Shemp. But I don't know if... keep in mind that what politics seems to be motivated by now isn't so much passionate support of somebody's ideals, somebody who can inspire some sort of, you know, join me as we march to improve the world for future generations. It's motivated by fear, anger,
and ideology.
And anger toward the opponent, toward somebody I don't want you in office more than I, you know, don't want her in office, so I'm going to go and vote for her. And I think that's a phenomenon that will unify Democrats in the support of Joe Donnelly, because again, what's the alternative for them? I don't know if the Three Stooges analogy is correct, but I mean, it's still not something that would sit well with most.
He needs to worry about Democratic support. He needs to worry about maybe picking off independent voters or even some Republican voters. Can he get enough Republican women to support him?
I think at this point the answer is yes. I think that going back to a previous answer, I think that the nature of the primary has hurt the Republicans, whomever it is that comes out of that as the winner, and they're going to have a lot of people to court, including women.
Keep in mind, you don't need people to go vote for you.
You just need them not
you
to
need
vote
them not
for
to vote for anybody else.
Else.
So if they're disengaged, that accomplishes much the same thing.
Well, finally, a Republican candidate challenging incumbent Congressman Larry Bouchon in the 8th District is running her campaign from Japan. 25-year-old Rachel Covington is teaching English there and says she'll move back to Indiana if she gets the GOP nomination. But we learned this week that when she requested her absentee ballot to vote in the primary, she pulled a Democratic one, which means she can't even vote for herself. Mike O'Brien, this year we've seen a lot of young people and women running for office, but should Rachel have taken a pass?
And not told voters that I'll move there, if I'll move back to the country if you pick me. Yeah, that's not an effective message necessarily. This is a lot like, I see a lot of consistencies with the Tea Party that we experienced back in 2010. It's a lot of energy and it's a lot of new people involved. Then they show up and they go, oh, this is like way harder than I thought it was going to be. So we'll see if that follows.
Is this
the same,
one of the more bizarre the campaigns?
You know, it's just you look at Larry Bouchon. Okay, I don't know what he's doing there. I don't know what Rakita's doing there. I don't know what any of them are doing there. When you look back on the history of Indiana, whether there were Democrats in control of the White House or the House or the Senate or Republicans, we had leaders here. You know, we had Charlie Halleck, we had Brademas, we had Lee Hamilton, we had Frank McCluskey. Now.
Well,
that's
all they want to do.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and political analyst John Katzenberger. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and the new WFYI app. And all of us here want to send our love to producer Mike Perry and his family. We're thinking about you. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.